Welcome to Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October 16th, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by the LaScalzo Institute of Kaplan Company and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be helping you this week to take a look at some of the things that developed during the week when you were trying to get rid of those final individual returns. So we're coming up now here past the final individual return date, so there's still a few of us out here who may have some 990s to work with for November. But aside from that, we're now done, shall we say, with calendar year 2016's tax year. And we're ready to get ready to look forward to, in not too terribly long, dealing with the 2017 tax year. But in the interim, let's take a look at what's been happening. This week, we're going to talk about the fact that the IRS issued not unexpectedly filing due date relief for victims of the Northern California wildfires. We're going to take a look at a return to court, deja vu all over again, to quote Yogi Berra, of a minister's housing allowance exclusion challenge that reappeared in the courts in Wisconsin. We're going to talk about the tax court is going to indicate its disagreement with a First Circuit decision regarding what exactly needs to happen to subordinate a mortgage if you're making a conservation easement contribution. The IRS removed the requirement for a partner's signature on a 754 election. We're going to have an issue that looks at how long of a period do you have to pay interest if your tax-exempt organization has a retroactive loss of tax-exempt status. And we'll have a brief email where the IRS raises an issue that may apply if you have a taxpayer who's been granted relief from disasters for having to file things on time. There may be a problem if you have a statute that's expiring during that time frame, a statute for the IRS to assess tax. Well, this week we're going to take a look at, as we say, a number of these issues. But first, I want to remind you that Don Cochran will be broadcasting next week two basically webcast CPE sessions that are being presented by the California Society of CPAs and are being picked up by a number of the state societies that are participating in this broadcast. On October the 23rd, it'll be a full-day session on Introduction to International Taxation. And on the 24th, the Construction Contractors for Tax and Accounting Issues. Both of those sessions begin at 8:30 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. That'd be 11:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You can check your state society's website. Many state societies have links and have gone with California Society of CPAs to offer these nationwide broadcasts. Or you can also go directly to the Cal CPA website. Obviously, if you go to your state society's website, that's you can qualify for your member discounts. So makes the most sense to go there and check and look for these options being available at that standpoint. But it gives you a chance to pick up a couple of courses, especially the international taxation course, that might be a little more difficult to get in many areas of the country just because it's tough to get enough people to sign up for the course. So consider signing up for either one of those courses coming on the 23rd and 24th. Again, they're webcasts, so wherever you are, you can pick up those courses. Let's start with our first development this week and want to raise the issue because this came out right on Friday, late on Friday. The IRS and news release IR 2017-172 has granted relief for filing dates to victims of the Northern California wildfires. Those in the impacted disaster areas, and again, since this is a developing situation, you want to keep checking the IRS website to see how broadly this disaster area has spread, because we continue to have developments in this area. But for due dates after October the 8th, the requirement to file those documents on those due dates has been delayed until January 31st of 2018. Now, as the IRS noted in the hurricane relief that we've had for Harvey, Irma, and Maria, if your client got an extension to file back in April and they didn't pay all the tax due at that time, well, those failure to pay penalties and the interest will continue to run during this period. We don't just get it until the end of January and we stopped running interest as of October 8th. The issue there is the actual date for doing that, it should have been paid back in April. So the idea being you weren't prevented from paying it by the wildfire. You merely hadn't gotten around to doing what you should have done back in April. So remember, those things still happen. So again, you might not want to delay too long if your client has some money due, but otherwise all the due dates are delayed until January the 31st. And the IRS in the news release notes that that includes the October 16th extended individual due date. It would also include a number of payroll and excise tax returns that could be due during that time period. For instance, obviously we have the third quarter 941s that are going to be due at the end of October. Those would be extended, number of issues in that realm. We also have the payroll tax relief. Payroll tax deposits due after October 8th and before October 23rd will be considered timely if they are deposited by October the 23rd, which is a week from, you know, this Monday, the Monday we release this podcast. So, you know, you can get it done by those dates. That'll be there. Again, if things develop in California, we might see that slide a little bit. It depends upon if these fires get contained and stay contained. That'll be a key issue. Now, the IRS notes, as they did with the hurricanes, that taxpayers who have an address of record in the disaster area should obtain this relief automatically without doing anything additional. Though they do warn you that if you do get a notice about late filing and you have an address in that area, you should call the number on the notice and explain that, you know, you live in the area that's covered by the disaster and you should get relief. Other people who may have, let's say, books and records in the area, but whose address is not in the area, who may be firefighters working in the area, the IRS there says you're going to need to contact the IRS at 866-562-5227 in order to ask for relief in those situations. So again, if you don't have an address of record, but you qualify otherwise, either because your business records are located in the disaster area, or you are somebody like a firefighter or a philanthropic organization, relief worker who's working in the area, and you need the additional time, you have to call the 866 number. Again, all of this is in the IRS news release, IR 2017-172. Next up, we have the issue that has come back to us. This is, as we say, deja vu all over again, although at least this time with a different name. This is the case of Gaylor et al. Versus Mnuchin et al. We actually changed everybody's name here because previously the lead was the lead one was the Freedom from Religion Foundation, and at the time the prior case came, Liu was the Treasury Secretary. So now we've got Steve Mnuchin as the lead defendant, and we have Gaylor, who is one of the parties who was the employee, who is also a lead plaintiff in the case. But this is a repeat of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, Inc. versus Liu case that was issued back in November of, the opinion was issued November of 2014 from the Seventh Circuit. If you remember that case, the question was a minister's housing allowance unconstitutional? Did the exclusion under 107.2 of the Internal Revenue Code, that is 107 parentheses two, it's one of those rare sections where they didn't put a letter, they went with numbers. So we have that particular provision of the code. Is that exemption for the housing allowance, is that unconstitutional? You may remember that originally the district court in Wisconsin, the Western District, had ruled that it violated the U.S. Constitution's Establishment Clause. The case went on appeal to the Seventh Circuit, in which case the Seventh Circuit decided we're not going to touch that issue because that's a bombshell waiting to happen. We're going to go back and say, hey, you know what? We think we can just say that the Freedom from Religion Foundation didn't have standing because they never asked the IRS if their employees could have exclusions for their housing allowances. So, you know, since they never were denied the benefit that was given to these ministers, they had no standing to sue. Well, as I remarked at the time, and I did that, this is before, you know, when we had the written manuals, I had remarked at that point writing that up that seems like the Seventh Circuit gave an obvious way that this is going to end up back in the court. Ladies and gentlemen, it's back here now. The plaintiffs did go ahead and file claims for refund. Now, if you've worked with the IRS on claims for refund, this will not surprise you, but it certainly causes a bit of a hassle in the court. The IRS actually paid the first refund claim they received, so they gave back money based on a housing allowance for this non-minister. Then they took the second claim that came in, they held it, and after 6 months, they still hadn't ruled on it. And then a third claim they effectively denied. Well, the taxpayers filed suit, including the one who had the claim that was not ruled upon within 6 months. After the suit was filed, the IRS denied that claim. Now we're back in court and they're saying, well, we've now have been harmed. Now we can no longer say we haven't been harmed. We've been harmed now, assuming that this is illegal. The case came back to the same judge that heard the first one. So not surprisingly, since the Seventh Circuit had never actually gone into the question of whether this violated the Constitution's Establishment Clause, this judge again ruled that it violates the Establishment Clause. And the judge concluded that by saying that effectively, for this provision, which says that the rental allowance paid to a minister of the gospel, and that is the term used in the code, is not part of their is not going to be taxable to the extent it's used to pay rent. Now, this is a second half of the first half was the old parsonage rule that said if a church provided a parsonage to the minister, right, a home furnished to them directly, that was excludable. This was added back in the 50s when the parsonage kind of went out of favor and we started shifting to, you know, just telling the ministers, go find some place to live and we'll hand you some money. So the challenge here is not to the parsonage. The challenge here is to the allowance paid. Okay, subtle difference, but it's important because the judge specifically denies an attempt later to say, well, you should also rule that 107.1, the parsonage, is unconstitutional. Said, nope, that's not before us here. And that is a whole different area. And the judge kind of outlined how that one may still be just fine. But this other one is a bit of a problem. Well, the court, as we said, not surprisingly, found this unconstitutional. The court found that to be constitutional, it would need to pass a three-factor test. And it said, if it fails any one of these three tests, it's unconstitutional. We look at the Establishment Clause. First, if the law has no secular purpose, it fails the Establishment Clause. If the law's primary effect advances or inhibits religion, it fails under the Establishment Clause. Or if the law fosters an excessive entanglement with religion. The court went on to effectively state that you could condense those into saying whether the statute conveys a message of endorsement viewed from the perspective of a reasonable observer of the religion in question. The court found that any reasonable observer would have to conclude that this was a support to religion with no secular purpose aside from supporting religion so that it would be considered unconstitutional. However, what then becomes kind of funny is the court goes on and then tries to figure out, okay, so what do we do now? And the court actually punted on this. They said, well, nobody really told us what to do. It really seems weird to allow the refund claims because that's expanding a statute, which the court concluded Congress could fix multiple ways by, you know, covering, let's say, offering free housing to people that work for housing allowances to people working for not-for-profits. That would expand it to non-religious, non-church, not-for-profits, that would be okay. The court also addressed a couple of other ways Congress could solve this, and the court said, we really don't want to be in the business of writing law. You know, it's up to Congress to fix this. And the court also said, and nobody really argued yet for the issue, so it kind of put out arguments and then said, oh, by the way, we also wonder if any potential effect of this should be stayed anyway pending the appeal. Almost certainly we're going to have an appeal. So in any event, we're back and probably going back to the Seventh Circuit. Next up, we have Pamala Building Investors, LLC versus Commissioner. This is 149 TC number 18, issued on October 10th. In this case, we have a mortgage. The question here is, the issue here is we have a mortgage on property that we're giving a conservation easement on. In this particular case, the mortgage holders did sign a subordination agreement, but as part of the deed, there were two things reserved. Number one, if there was an insurance payout on related to this property, the mortgage holders got their money immediately ahead of anybody. So it wasn't that a portion of the insurance proceeds went to the charity. Everything had to go to the mortgage holder. And then number two, if there was a condemnation, the same rule applied. Condemnation proceeds first went to the mortgage holder. Now, the First Circuit Court of Appeals in a similar case, the case of Kaufman, had ruled back in 2011, overturned the tax court and stated that, in fact, those sorts of restrictions were not considered to be a problem in terms of not making your gift in perpetuity. The tax court now, this case coming back and the appeal would go to the Seventh Circuit, says that, no, we disagree with that. We're going to hold, because we've had other cases since then where we have very strictly applied the subordination rule, and other circuits have supported us. Now, the specific issue of these two carve-outs hadn't really been discussed, but the other circuits had backed them up on a very strict reading of this rule that you couldn't fix it later. The First Circuit had said, well, this just doesn't make sense because, see, guys, if you look at this, it's not in perpetuity because the charity might not get something if the property had been foreclosed upon, you know, these various things that could happen. If, you know, because of that contingency, they're saying, well, you know, basically, if you're saying because of these two much more remote contingencies, if that's enough to blow it, then the First Circuit said you never could make a conservation easement donation because, you know what? If the owner of the property doesn't pay his property taxes in the future, you know, the state, county will get a lien on the property, which will automatically be superior to that of the charity. And because of that, they said, well, no claim could ever be done. You know, no deduction could ever be allowed. The court said, no, we're not saying that. We're saying, look, saying two key issues to factor. Number one, a mortgage is a current liability and claim on the property. This lien from unpaid property taxes 5 years down the line is a potential claim on the property, not a current claim. Number two, they said, the regulations discuss having to subordinate mortgages as part of meeting this test. They don't discuss anything about property tax liens that aren't currently existing. So the tax court announces that outside the First Circuit, they're going to continue to apply a very strict subordination rule for conservation easements. Because what the court found was the donation was not in perpetuity per the regulations. This reminds us, as always, that where you are is important. There basically are now, and will be unless we get a case that goes to the Supreme Court or one of the courts changes its mind, there are different rules effectively for conservation easements for those taxpayers who live in areas that are governed by the First Circuit Court of Appeals that are within their jurisdiction than there are for taxpayers in the rest of the country. So it's important to understand that and understand, you know, be careful. What's very clear is the tax court, though, made it clear that if you don't live in the First Circuit, you're not going to be able to rely upon Kaufman, at least before the tax court. You're going to have to find another circuit that would go ahead and agree to read your case like Kaufman. Now, we don't know. Maybe Palmolive Building Investors will take this to the Seventh Circuit, and maybe the Seventh Circuit will agree with the First Circuit, or maybe not. We'll just have to watch. The IRS in proposed regulation 1.754-1, which was issued as part of REG-116-256-17, found in the Federal Register on October 12th of this year, the IRS has now removed the signature requirement on a 754 election for a partnership. As you all probably remember from your partnership work, if there are certain transactions take place in a partnership, for instance, if there is a transfer of partnership interest under or a distribution of property, if either of those occur, then and certain other conditions are met under either Section 743 or Section 734 of the code, a partnership can make an election under Section 754 that will adjust the basis to take into account those transactions and what they say about the value of property being held by the partnership. Now, the 74 adjustment may only affect one partner in the case of a transfer of an interest, or it may affect all remaining partners in the case of one that is triggered by a distribution of property to a leaving partner. But the real problem we had was we've gone to electronic filing of partnership returns to a large extent. The catch is the old regulation said you had to attach a statement to the return. Well, that's no problem. We do that electronically. But then that statement also had to be signed by a partner separate from signing the return. Well, that's a bit of a hassle because obviously the way you'd have to do that effectively is to get a piece of paper, get it signed, get it attached as a PDF, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, the IRS was discovering a lot of taxpayers, or probably their tax advisor, their CPA firm, were putting an election on but didn't get it signed. Then somebody noticed that, and we have a problem. The problem you have in that case is there are only two ways to get a fix if you forgot to get it signed. If you caught it within a year, the automatic relief rules of Regulation 301.9100-2 could be used. That's one of those 12-month fixes. That's a just do it, file an amended partnership return that changes nothing except it adds the piece of paper with the signature. But that has to be done within 12 months of the original due date with extensions. The problem we run into is, of course, what if we're beyond that date? In that case, the only problem was we could still get relief, but that was under Reg 301.9100-3, and that required asking the service for release, and that meant applying for and paying for a private letter ruling request. Whenever the IRS gets a bunch of these requests, what ends up happening is at some point they decide, because they don't really like to handle them, they decide to try to get rid of them, and this is what they've decided here. They decided there's really not much point in having that signature anymore. So they issued a proposed regulation that's going to go into Reg 1.754-1 and simply remove the requirement to have a signature. After it is revised, the requirement you're going to have to do is just simply have the name and address of the partnership and contain a declaration the partnership elects under Section 754 to apply the provisions of Section 734B and Section 743B. Effectively, getting rid of what was the middle requirement under the old reg, which required a partner's signature as part of that statement. Now, the other nice thing the service did with this, they are proposed regs, which generally don't take effect right away, but in the preamble, they tell us taxpayers may rely on this regulation for prior returns, for returns filed prior to the date this takes effect. Now, it's interestingly worded because it didn't say for returns filed after the date this was issued, October 12th, and before it's published. It just says for returns filed before. That suggests that potentially the way the service wants this read is don't send us any more of these private letter ruling requests. You know, we're just going to grandfather you in. I wish they'd been a little more explicit if that's what they mean, because you and I both know that you could very well have an agent 5 years from now arguing that, well, it didn't say earlier ones counted. I don't think they do. And you're off and running with a lot of time in an exam trying to fix something. So we'll have to see. But nevertheless, this is good news. Certainly, I would expect our tax software now to simply make a 754 election to be a very simple check the box. And there'll be no special things to do when you're processing that return, except to verify that election got attached, that election got generated by your tax software, and then it'll be transmitted to the service. Next up, we have the case of Credit Guard of America versus Commissioner, another published tax court decision. We had quite a few of those this week. 149 TC number 17, issued on October the 10th. This is an organization that had claimed to be tax exempt, and they started in 2002. The IRS started an exam in 2003 looking at their 990, and eventually, in 2013, it was finally determined. In late 2012, the IRS issued their final decision on this, which retroactively denied this organization's tax-exempt status back to 2002. And in 2013, after they filed a tax court petition, they basically entered into a stipulated decision which agreed that they retroactively lost their tax-exempt status. The service had agreed not to assert penalties. However, it didn't say anything much about interest. And the entity, which, by the way, the amount of tax involved here was not insignificant. The tax involved in this case was $216,547. That's kind of bad. But when they got the interest number, the IRS started computing interest as of the due date for the first 1120. That would have been in March of 2003, which has now been going on for a decade. So we had another six-figure amount of interest that was due. The organization says, wait a minute. You know, that interest shouldn't have started until 2013, because until then we were a tax-exempt organization. And, you know, only after it was decided that we didn't have that status you know, at that point, tax became due. And so the interest should only run from 2013, which is when we entered into the stipulated decision, not all the way back to 2003. Unfortunately for the organization, the tax court did not agree. The court agreed that, in essence, this is a retroactive revocation is just what it says it is. You never were tax exempt. Because you never were tax exempt, that tax was due in March of 2003. It remained unpaid all the way through that exam period while you were contesting that, you know, you were still taking the position, you were an exempt org, but you have now agreed you're not, you were never exempt. Having agreed to that, the interest starts running from the original due date of the 1120 that should have been filed had you been properly treated as not a tax-exempt entity all the way back from the day you started. Makes a huge difference in interest. So, interesting case. Interesting, too, because it's a published opinion. We never really had this issue decided by the courts. Now, we may not like the decision, but we certainly have one now. Next up, we have a interesting chief counsel email. It's a very short one. Emailed advice 2017-40021. It was issued on October the 6th. This deals with disaster relief, like we were talking about for the California wildfires earlier. This brief email, though, takes a simple position. It was discussing the Florida relief on Irma, but it would apply as much to Harvey, Maria, and now the wildfire relief in California. It notes that under Section 7508 Cap A, basically its position is, let's say that you had a due date. Let's say that you have a taxpayer living in the wildfire areas in California. You had, the IRS was looking at their return for a prior year. The statute of limitations on assessing tax for that year was due to expire on October 31st of this year. So you think we're running right to the statute and, you know, the service is not going to figure out they haven't assessed the tax. Aha, we'll get out of this. Well, not so fast, according to this email. Because your taxpayer now lives in an area where the due date for filing now, the secretary has suspended, right, the any dates that come during that period and moved them to January 31st of 2018, now your statute's not going to expire until January 31st of 2018. That is, the law clearly provides that there's a whole list of things that could be extended under this rule. And the memo briefly points out, that's how it works. And then it says, you know, go look at the examples in the regulations. And interestingly enough, we do have an example in the reg that also talks about this abatement period being expanded. But the interesting part about the reg is, while the law could be read to say that, you know, you have to do all of these as a group, the actual reg suggests that the IRS could pick and choose. And even better, the example specifically that they state was one that is one of those where they say, you know, here's part one of the example. They talk about extending due dates for filing, et cetera. But then in example two, they said, well, you know, the statute was closing. And that example, the second example says, effectively, it's interesting what it starts with. It says, you know, the facts are the same. So we've had the hurricane, has been damaged, you know, all these things have happened. That, but it says, except that because of the severity of the hurricane, the IRS determines that postponement of government acts is necessary. Now, this suggests that government act suspension is separate and apart from extending the regular due date. This isn't mentioned in the email. And as far as I can tell, looking at the notices the IRS has given us on all of these disasters from Harvey, Irma, Maria, and now the Northern California wildfires, not yet seen any mention of extending government acts during that period. But this email takes position that, they've been extended too. The caveat is, if you have a taxpayer in an affected area and you've got a statute for the IRS to assess tax that was going to expire during that period, like let's say it was going to expire on October 15th of 2017, because, you know, it was a 2013 return, it was filed on extension on the last day, so you think the statute is expiring on Monday. Well, may not be expiring on Monday, at least according to this email. It may not really expire till January of next year. that opens up some issues. Now, I think it's pretty clear that the statute for refund, which is probably how they're going to link this, is it seems like it gets to there, and that's probably the good news about this. But if you're kind of waiting out a statute and hoping it goes away before the service notes, you might have a little more time to wait than you thought you did. Well, as we always want to remind you, this is again brought to you by your State Society of CPAs, and we're heading into Major League CPE season. So all of you, be sure to check out your State Society's websites for the courses they're offering now. You know, take a look at what's coming up. Consider what you need to know. Look at your clients right now. You know, the nice thing about the State Society programs is they tend to have many, many more options for longer specialized course topics than you're going to find in other alternative CPE. So if you need 8 hours on partnership taxation, this is one of the few places you can really get 8 hours on partnership taxation that you can get with a live instructor who is going to be there that you can ask questions of. So be sure to check your State Society of CPAs, find out what's out there. There's lots of things going on right now, and we still have whatever happens with tax reform. So keep your eyes open. We expect lots of things to be going on. And be sure to get your CPE now. It's that time of year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for the week of October 16th. Be sure to catch the daily updates, but certainly at various times during the week, that I publish on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF that will have articles describing everything we talked about today, along with links to supporting documents. If you want to go look at the actual, you know, get your hands on the real document, which is somewhat important to look at real documents, especially for something that's crucial to your client. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me. EdZollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is the email address you can send it to. You can also follow me on Twitter. You'll find me there at EdZollers is where you'll find me on Twitter. With that, hope all you got all your tax returns filed. Hope your clients are all happy with the results they had. Yeah, that'll be the day. Nevertheless, you're done with one more tax season for everything except those 990s. And we look forward to talking to you next week about what starts happening now with Current Federal Tax Developments from now through the end of the year.